Welcome back to the Science of Work podcast, where I'm your host, Dr. Lisa Belanger, and we take a deep dive into the habits, skills, work design, and leadership behind global trends in today's workforce. We talk a lot about optimizing work design. While this can mean updating policies, technology, workflow, etc., for most of us, the limiting factor can be the human factor. What will have a high ROI is really how well our brain functions and our ability to relate to others. While conflict is just a fact of life, in our personal and professional lives, we often are not taught how to manage conflict. Because conflict is stressful, many of us tend to avoid it. However, we know tension or productive conflict can help us move forward, innovate, and create. We want different opinions and experiences and a diverse workforce on our team. So why don't we lean into conflict? And why don't we get taught how to manage it? Today, I talked to Amy Gallo. She is an expert in conflict, communication, and workplace dynamics. She is the author of HBR's Guide to Dealing with Conflict and the forthcoming Getting Along, How to Work with Anyone, Even Difficult People. She is the co-host of Harvard Business Review's Women at Work podcast. She is a contributing editor at Harvard Business Review, and she has written hundreds of articles on managing people, building your career, giving back, and emotional intelligence. She is on the faculty of the Emotional Intelligence Coaching Certificate Program, previously taught at Brown University, and is a graduate of both Brown and Yale University. She currently lives in Providence, Rhode Island, with her family and their dog. I cannot wait to hear her process on how to deal with even the most difficult people. The Science of Work is brought to you by the Quantic School of Business and Technology. Quantic's highly selective online MBA and executive MBA are designed with interactive micro-lessons and individualized feedback every 8 seconds. Experience the future of education. Go to quantic.edu/scienceofwork for more. Conflicts are generally not fun. They often are stress-provoking, and for me, anyway, it's the thing that keeps me up at night more than work itself. Our work, while moving towards working from home or hybrid, are reliant on technology. Our productivity, innovation, creativity, and ability to relate to others will be the most important human factors in the future of work. While conflicts can be a simple part of humans working together, if they're not managed appropriately in a timely manner, they can create low productivity, stress, employee turnover, and impact service delivery. Not all conflicts are bad. It is important to address the root cause of the conflict and that they are addressed as soon as they're noticed. Knowing this is going to just be part of work. Being able to design and implement a specific plan on how we personally manage conflict, and I mean that we as individuals, but within the workplace, how can we set it up that people know how to conflict with each other, how to create and move forward with these conflicts? I'm so excited to talk to our guest today, and honestly, after the interview, it's completely changed my perspective on conflict.
This idea of conflict or difficult conversations, why do you think as humans, we tend to back away from this and avoid these things?
I think there's two primary reasons. Number one, we are hardwired for likability. It's how we survived when we lived in tribes. We wanted people to like us so that we could share resources, watch each other's backs, all of that. So we want people to like us, we want to get along with people, and conflict and difficult conversations for most of us seem like a rupture in that connection or have the potential to cause that rupture or fracture in those relationships. The second reason is that most of us see conflict as a threat. So not only a threat to that harmony we have with other humans, but also a threat to our resources or our identity or our career, especially conflict at work. And when we perceive a threat, we go into what emotional intelligence experts call amygdala hijack, where the rational thinking part of our brain is dominated by the reptilian instinctual reactive part of our brain. And that doesn't feel good. You know, I talk to audiences all the time about conflict and difficult conversation. I ask them to say, what's one word you would use to describe how you felt during your most recent conflict? And it's never things like joyous, excited, calm, right? It's always anxious, frustrated, vulnerable, nervous. And that's that threat response kicking in. We don't want to have the conflict. We don't want to have the difficult conversation. We don't want our relationship with this other person, even if it's someone we don't intend to spend a lot of time with. You know, we still don't want to experience that rupture in the social connection.
Do you think that there's any gender divide with this concept or notion?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of research that's been done, and we talk about this a lot on the Women at Work podcast, that shows that there's typically a double bind when it comes to issues where, like, negotiation or being assertive at work, particularly around what we think of as leaders. And that double bind is the idea that one behavior that works for men doesn't always work for women. And typically women are penalized for being assertive, for advocating for themselves, for negotiating. We know from tons of research that's been done around salary negotiation that women do suffer a penalty when they negotiate their salary, especially if they do it on behalf of themselves, meaning this is what I deserve, this is what I'm worth, versus this is what's best for my team, or this is what's best for the group. So that double bind of we expect leaders, we expect people in organizations and companies to act assertive, confident, you know, what we typically see as leaderly, you know, putting that in air quotes. When women do those things, we tend to think less of them, and they suffer a penalty in terms of promotions, you know, evaluations, feedback, all of those things that matter in an organization.
So I don't want to leave it there. Is there anything we can do about that? Is there any solve to this problem? Because I understand that that is true, but we also don't want them not negotiating their salary or, you know, striving towards leadership positions.
That's exactly right. And I'm so glad you asked that follow-up question, because this is some of the most depressing research. I'm always like, wait, what? Like, this is not fun to hear. And of course, we don't want women to stop negotiating or to advocate for themselves. What the researchers who've looked at this have seen is that you can mitigate some of that penalty by actually leaning in a little bit to the gender norms, because the reason women are penalized is because they are violating what we think of as typical feminine behavior, which is to care about the collective, to be in service of others, you know, to really be focused on the group. And what you can do is actually lean into that a little bit. So think about when you negotiate for a raise, for more resources for your team, that you contextualize it as what's best for the entire organization or what's best for your team. Now, I will tell you, that's exhausting mental gymnastics to have to do. But I also believe that these tactics are effective no matter what your gender. They're just more imperative for women to do. So men, you can use those same sorts of tactics of negotiating with compassion, empathy, having a collective mindset while they're doing it. And I think it'll make the negotiation go better for them too. It's just not as imperative that men do it.
That completely makes sense. And I think that that idea of collective, regardless of gender, is so important, regardless if you're negotiating or not. And we're seeing in the literature, empathy becoming one of the primary leadership skills that we're looking at, especially in the last couple of years. So my theory is that these tend to be women-centric or more predominantly in women. So hopefully we'll see a shift in leadership values, but we'll see. We'll see how it goes.
I would love to see that. And I do think we could all benefit from some of what we often called softer skills, which is so
weird. I like to call them essential skills.
Thank you. Yes. And I think organizations would be better off if we had a lot of those skills that we typically associate with women. I mean, there's nothing inherent in how we're born that would make us behave in certain ways. It's all socialization in terms of what our expectations are. So there's no reason a woman couldn't advocate for herself or negotiate a salary just as well as a man would, but you have to take into the context, you know, take into account. Exactly.
And it's really based on rewards and what we've been rewarded for our whole lives, either gender, regardless. And what we're seeing now, and this goes to the greater context, is we are shifting what we're rewarded for in work in general, because of the work from home, because of the transition, the reimagination of work. And then certainly the great resignation, adding a little bit more power onto the employees than we've had before. So it's going to be interesting to see how this progresses over the next few years. And I can't imagine how interesting it is from your lens.
Absolutely.
So How do you approach a difficult conversation or a conflict?
There are four things I try to do anytime I'm about to have a conversation or I'm trying to figure out what exactly I want to do. I'll go through the four, and I'm sure people will be listening going, wait, you expect me to do all of that when someone says something obnoxious in a meeting? Or it's going to sound like it takes a long time. But usually these are things you, with practice, you can do very quickly in your head. The first thing is to think about the other person, because that threat response I talked about, the amygdala hijack, that tends to make us naturally narcissistic. We focus on what we stand to gain or what we stand to lose. We lose sight of the other person. We start telling ourselves a story about them and their behavior, right? Like Lisa did that because she's a passive aggressive jerk and always has been, right? We get totally focused on that. And so to try to sort of break out of that rumination, you really want to think about what's going on with the other person. What would motivate them to behave this way? What is it they want out of the situation? Do they tend to be a conflict avoider? Are they someone who does occasionally act passive aggressively? Might they be under scrutiny from their boss? Really just try to think through all the possible things that could be going on for this person and try to do that in a generous way. Not because I think that person necessarily deserves your empathy or your generosity, they may not, but because it's good for you. It's a good strategic move if you can sort of get yourself into an empathetic mindset, because then you're going to approach the conflict much less charged, much less activated, and be able to navigate it more carefully and thoughtfully.
Responding versus reacting.
Exactly. And trying to break yourself out of that story, because if I go into a conversation with you and I'm in my head going passive aggressive, that's how she behaved, right? You're going to pick up on that. And that conversation's not going to go well. And ultimately what I want and need is not going to happen if you also are activated and reacting rather than responding, right? The second step is to really figure out what are you actually disagreeing about? I think sometimes it feels crystal clear. We're disagreeing over this project plan and who gets to make the call. But I really encourage people to think carefully, what else is going on? What other factors could be happening? Because so much, you know, I occasionally do some mediation. And what I see is that what people think the conversation is initially about, often it's other underlying issues. And so really think carefully, what are the many issues that might be going on? Maybe it's that you disagree over the goal of the project, but you also disagree about how to carry out the project. And you have an underlying disagreement about how you treat one another, because this person sends you curt emails or, you know, has gone behind your back before to your boss, you know, so really try to separate out the various things and try to start with the simplest, like the goal of the project, that hopefully would be a relatively easy thing to sort of sort out. Start with that so you can pave the way of we've got something in common, we're able to agree on something, and then you can sort of address some of the larger, more thorny issues that might be going on. The third is to figure out what you actually want yourself. Like, what's the goal of this conflict? What do you need at the end of it? And you might have multiple goals. You might want the project to get done on time. You might need to look good to your boss. You might need to get this report out to a client as soon as possible. You might want to preserve your relationship with the other person because you're going to have to work together 18 more times this year. Really, you can have multiple goals, but figure out what's the most important to you. And can you find a goal that overlaps with the other person's? Because if you have a shared objective, that's a great place to start the conversation. And then the fourth is to then decide. So take all of those things. And I've sort of put that last because I think we automatically think, well, I'm going to just call this person. We're going to hash it out. Or I'm going to just ignore this person and we're not going to discuss it, right? I'm going to do nothing. And we get very, you know, knee jerk about that. And I think the reason you want to do those first three steps, think about the other person, know what you're disagreeing about, figure out your goal, is so that you can then make a thoughtful decision about what you actually want to do. And sometimes the right thing to do is just let it go. Not always, but sometimes. And sometimes the right thing is to sit down and hash out. Sometimes the right thing is to bring in someone else to help you sort this problem out.
And then knowing how you're coming into the conversation too, I think is so important, you know, like being able to not take a really difficult budget conversation into talking to a five-year-old, like being able to separate that a little bit and kind of understanding and calling yourself out and having that self-awareness of what heat you're bringing in.
One of the questions I try to ask myself, you know, I'll go through this process. I'll decide, okay, I'm going to do this. And then I have to always check myself, because I think what you're talking about is ultimately self-awareness, is I have to ask myself, what if I'm wrong? and just sort of try to open my thinking to be a little more receptive to what am I not seeing here? And sometimes that means calling my best friend and just saying, hey, listen, this is what's going on. Yeah. You know me. What am I doing here? Like, what's my role in this? Because we always play a role.
And I have to know, do you win every argument with your spouse?
Oh, gosh.
And your teenage daughter, correct?
Yes, I have a 14-year-old daughter. I do not win all those arguments. I'll tell you, 14-year-olds are incredibly good. She's also really into debate and mock trial. So she's like a master arguer. My spouse, it's funny. It depends what you mean by win. I have learned over the years that sometimes not getting my way is a win because it preserves the relationship.
Right. The goal, the overarching goal.
Exactly.
Eternal love.
I mean, he would say, I have the conversation as if I want to win. He would definitely say that.
I mean, of course. So I love that you said it is part of love, like to value conflict and to value disagreement. Can you expand on that at all?
Interacting with other humans, if there was no conflict, it might feel good. I don't know. It might feel pleasant, but it just seems so unrealistic. And in all of my relationships, those relationships where we just got along all the time, it was because one or both of us actually just wasn't saying things that we were unhappy about or we disagreed about. So the willingness to speak up, the willingness to call someone out, the willingness to say, this is not what I need, or I don't see it the same way. For me, that's an expression of love. And it's showing, I trust you. I value you. I'm willing to show up as completely as myself in this conversation or in this interaction and be vulnerable, because navigating conflict is, it makes you vulnerable. In my experience, both personal and professional, the people who I can have conflicts with, the people who I can just say, oh God, I don't see it that way, or I'm on a completely different page, let's hash this out. Those are the people I end up feeling closest to because I feel safe. You know, it's a psychological safety to be able to disagree and work it out or not sometimes, and then move on.
And I raise this question because I question this all the time and I talk about psychological safety. And we talk about showing up authentically as ourselves. Mm-hmm. What if your authentic self is a terrible person that day? Or your authentic self is kind of a jerk? Do we have to put ourselves through filters, especially when we come to work? Arguably other conversations, but especially as we come to work.
The short answer is yes. If your authentic self that day is a crabby, grumpy complainer,
sleep deprived,
sick, right? Like all those things, showing up as your authentic self and ruining everyone else's day, taking the meeting off track. You may get points for showing up authentically, but you're going to lose so many more points for, you know, basically being the black cloud over everyone's day. So I do think there are days and times where we filter. And you asked about a bad day. I think the key is this a time-limited feeling? Let's be clear. You may want to keep things private, but if there's something you really strongly feel about the strategy not being right, the team headed in the wrong direction, your displeasure with how people are interacting or the way they're treating one another, that's not something to stay silent about for a long time. And granted, on a bad day, you might think, wow, I really dislike all these people. I wish I didn't have to work with them. But you're not going to say that on Slack, right? You're not going to announce that.
Yeah.
So you do need to filter yourself on occasion, but it shouldn't be a long-term feeling that you need to cover something or hide something from people. Now, you did ask also, like, what if you're just a jerk?
Yeah.
I mean, I would say we can debate what being a jerk means, but if you're a pessimist, if you're someone who tends to look more on the negative side of things or point out the risks, there's time and place for that. So I don't think you have to hide that all the time, but use it strategically. And I think most people who are jerks don't know they're jerks. So I'm not even sure you'd have the awareness to say, oh, I'm a jerk. I shouldn't bring my authentic self to work, right?
Yeah. I like that, like the construct of just, is this a day thing, a couple weeks thing? Or is this actually how I feel in something that's going to cause turmoil in me? And so the next question I have to ask is, how do we deal with this when there's a difference in power? Mm. So if you are speaking up, and as I mean, like up the chain of command, or somebody that has a lot of power, and I would love to think they have the emotional intelligence and seeking out this feedback, but let's be honest, that's not always the case.
Yeah.
So how would you approach that situation?
And it's funny, I've written an article called How to Disagree with Someone More Powerful Than You. It's one of the most popular articles I've written for HBR, because I think a lot of people have this question. So a couple of things I would suggest. Number one, if you can, contract ahead of time with your boss. So at an annual performance review, or even in a one-on-one early on in your relationship, or you can even try this once you've worked with the person for a long time, say, occasionally we're going to disagree. We're not going to see eye to eye. How would you like me to handle those disagreements? How would you like me to raise them? You do that in a calm moment when you and your boss are on the same page, there's no existing conflict. And that helps basically give you tacit permission so that when you do have a disagreement, you can say, oh, you know, remember I had asked you about how to disagree. This is one of those times, right? And then you follow what they've suggested in terms of the best way to do that. It will then be an expected occurrence rather than the person being caught by surprise,
yeah, which is, I mean, you can even start the conversation with, remember when you said you'd like to be approached in this way? Could we make that meeting, whatever the protocol is? And then you're kind of framing it as, this was your idea.
Exactly. You asked me to do this, so I'm now doing this. One of the things you have to keep in mind is the more senior people get, the more or less they're receptive to feedback. And that's not because they're jerks. It's just because as you move up, you become more focused on delivering rather than receiving. It's just your responsibilities are more oriented to that. So you're really just trying to make sure you're not catching them off guard. The other thing I think I would do is when you disagree, is say, I don't see it the same way. Is it okay if I share my viewpoint? Now, that may sound really yes, exactly. But in my experience, 99% of the time, no one's ever going to say, nope, don't share your viewpoint. They're going to say yes. And then again, you have that tacit permission. It's basically both giving you the permission to speak up, but also giving them a moment to transition from delivering ideas to receiving ideas. We think that should be a relatively easy transition, but it's not always for people. And so I think giving them that moment to just sort of reset and say, oh, okay, you know, Lisa has something to tell me. The last thing I'll say is I think, especially when it comes to someone in power, we often focus on what we stand to lose if we speak up and the risks of speaking up, right? They'll give me a bad performance review. I won't get that raise. They'll ice me out. They won't come to me for input like they've always done. We sort of see all the things that might fall apart. And it's understandable. This person, you know, if they have more power than you, probably have control over your livelihood, when you take vacation, where you work and when, right? They have a lot of control. But what we often fail to do is think about the risks of not speaking up. We might think of that later, but I really like to reverse that risk assessment and start by thinking, what would I lose if I did not speak up about this? Is it respect for my team? Is it that this project will be miserable because we're going to do it the wrong way, right? Is it that the leader actually might lose respect for me because I didn't speak up about something that's important to me and they may learn that later on? Whatever those risks are, and then you can do the risk assessment of, okay, what are the risks of speaking up? Because there will always be risks on both sides. And then, you know, make a smart decision, because sometimes it's not the right thing to say something. I just think more often than not, we assume that when it's not the case.
Science of Work is brought to you by Quantic, transforming the traditional MBA and EMBA with interactive platform that's built for modern student and future leaders. With a focus on innovation and strategy and a mobile-first, network-driven approach, Quantic allows us to learn on your schedule and alongside leaders from the world's top companies. Visit quantic.edu/scienceofwork to learn more about the modern MBA.
So there is such a value in having conflict or having difficult conversations, however you want to look at it. When we think outside of work, where does that value sit? Like we talked about your teenage daughter, we talked about your spouse, but when we think on the broader context, how can this help you in the rest of life?
Beyond work. So not just in your professional realm. I mean, you called them essential skills. I think navigating conflict is one of those skills that's actually so few people have, especially at work, that it will give you such a leg up if you learn to master it. In your personal life, it just gives you a little bit more ease in walking through the world. I mean, I'll give you an example. I'm recording this in my makeshift closet podcast recording studio. There's a window here that has all these soundproof foam squares on them, but I still can hear a lot of noise if my neighbor happens to be in their driveway. And my neighbor has been homesick for a few days and was doing a project one day when I was trying to record a podcast. And I was like, oh, I need to go talk to him so he can be quiet during the podcast. And my husband was like, well, what are you going to say? I was like, I'm just going to tell him I'm recording a podcast. And he's like, what if this is the only time? I was like, well, I don't know. Why don't I just go ask? You know, and it was one of those moments where I was like, for some people, this would be incredibly hard to do, including my husband, who I've just totally revealed as a conflict averse person. This would be really hard to do, but it's just such a simple conversation for me, knowing the skills I have. It's just ease of mind of like, things are going to happen. People are inevitably, we're going to rub up against one another. There's going to be friction with neighbors, with family, with friends. And knowing that I can get through that, I won't always do the right thing, mind you. I've definitely made a lot of people mad. I've sometimes have not advocated for myself in the way I want to, but knowing that I ultimately can just puts me more at ease in terms of navigating all of these relationships.
You say that people will be mad at you and that that's okay.
Yes.
Go on.
So that is part of advocating for yourself and navigating conflict. Sometimes you're going to say things, want things, do things, need things that are going to make other people upset. That interaction with my neighbor went perfectly fine. He said, oh, no problem. I'll stop for 2 hours. He didn't care, but it could have been different. He could have said, well, this is the only day I have to get this project done. It could have gone very differently. He might have been mad that I had made that request, and I just had to be okay with that. And there are lots of people in my life who I've angered, as everyone has people in their life who they've angered. And I think the problem is when we imagine that, if we think about that person being upset with us and that becomes something we want to avoid at all costs, we end up sacrificing our own self, right? And our own needs.
It's the first time, like hearing your TED Talk and hearing that line, it's the first time I've ever been told that. Right? Yes. Like, I think there is a conditioning, socialization. I joked about being in Canada. I'm sure that's part of it.
Yeah.
Female, I'm sure that's part of it. But there's something about avoiding making other people upset. Like, how dare we make other people upset? But when we do that, we often make ourselves upset. And it could be a very simple conversation. Like, that's taking that, for whatever reason, out of our context of being like, what if we just explained ourselves and our point of view? And then they were like, yeah, no problem.
Yes.
And how much both of our lives would be easier because of that. And to your point, you'd even become closer. And I really liked your suggestion about looking at both sides of risk, because we tend to overemphasize, oh, what if we made them mad? What if it went terrible? What if we lost our job? Like, and we forget to think that this is an immense, amazing, essential skill, leadership skill, that if you're in a supportive environment, will be seen as such.
The other thing is that we tend to also think through how they're going to be mad at us before we even actually know, right? Like, my husband was already, well, like, well, what if that's the only time he can do it? How would I even know that information, right? And you might, of course, in a negotiation, in a conflict, think of what some of the objections might be, because you might have to have a conversation about that. But that shouldn't stop you from having the conversation. And there is always a risk someone's going to be mad at you. And the only way to guarantee that is to stop interacting with humans altogether. And I think that's a really horrible idea. I think we've definitely learned in the last 18 months that doesn't do good things for any of us, right?
And I think that that's such a good point, because I talk a lot about stress and resilience and burnout, and how much of our world is the stories in which we tell ourselves. And for whatever reason, we gravitate towards these really negative, dark stories instead of saying it's equally possible to have this really great ending.
That's right.
It's trying to navigate and be self-aware enough to be like, this is a story in which I am telling myself.
Yes.
So last question is, how has this changed in a virtual world? So difficult conversations in a virtual world, how should they be done? How has it changed? What should we consider?
Unfortunately, my observation, and I've talked to other people who do similar work who also are noticing the same, which is that the virtual world has made us even more conflict avoidant, right? It's harder to stop a Zoom meeting in the middle and try to get people's attention on something. It's harder to find time with people. And truthfully, you know, one of the things I've really been realizing in the last few months is just how less human I feel in this environment. And so all the things I need to navigate conflict effectively, resilience, compassion, emotional intelligence, empathy, they're just harder to access, at least for me. All of that makes this a much more conflict avoidant environment, which means that we need to be much more intentional about making it normal. And this was something I was saying right when the pandemic started, when lots of people were starting to work from home. This was a great opportunity to say, because we're all resetting these norms, how we're going to interact, but to say, we won't always agree, and that's okay. We want to have disagreements come up. And I think it means we have to carve out extra time in meetings. It means we have to be really deliberate. I mean, it's so easy to have a tense meeting and then just press that little red leave button and just be like, well, that's gone. But I think the more we do that, there's actually an author, Leanne Davey, a fellow Canadian, who talks a lot about...
I don't know her.
Yeah. I hope I didn't presume that all Canadians know each other. But she writes about a lot about team conflict, and she has this concept of conflict debt, which is that the longer you put off a discussion, a difficult conversation, the worse it gets, right? We know that those things fester and fester and they build up, and then you get deep into conflict debt. And I think a lot of teams, a lot of people are getting into conflict debt in these virtual environments because it's trickier to navigate. But we really need to say to ourselves, we can't let them go. We can't let the difficult conversations, we can't let the tension just sort of build. We can't leave them out of the equation because it's part of interacting. No matter how we're interacting, it's part of interacting. So set up that Zoom call with the colleague who you've been putting off the difficult conversation with. Try to be really intentional. The other thing is, this is an environment that's ripe for miscommunication and misunderstanding. So we also have to be very intentional about over-communicating. If I'm starting to look off camera or I turn off my camera in the middle of a tense conversation, people are going to read into that. So I have to be clear. I turned off my camera because someone was at the door, or I'm looking off screen because I'm keeping an eye on the clock because I have to pick up my daughter at 3. Just anything to help people not misinterpret your behavior and to really just check in constantly. I think we should constantly check in with one another.
I think that's such a great way to end this. Have a communication plan. Right? Mm-hmm. So as we're rethinking and reimagining work, as everybody's talking about it now, because whatever we're designing as companies is kind of like, how will it work now, whether that's hybrid, whether that's virtual, whether that's in office. So as part of this over communication plan, which everybody should be considering, is having, how are we going to manage conflict? And as leaders, how are we going to make sure the door is open for that support it in a way that it is productive? Anything else you'd like to say before?
Oh, I could talk about this topic for hours, but
I could listen to you talk about this topic for hours.
This has been such a fun conversation and great questions. So thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of The Science of Work. I know I'll be making battle plans with my team on how we disagree and the rules of engagement so that we can approach it much differently and we know how to effectively manage and move forward from conflict. To be fair, I might even do this in my own house so that conflict is moving forward and past. A special thank you to Amy Gallo for our conversation on this topic and for my team behind the scenes that make this podcast possible. Everything from research to audio to design. For full transcripts and additional sources, especially around workplace conflict, please visit our website at consciousworks.com. Remember, consciously design your day or somebody else will.